All right, well, we're going to, I was hoping that I could like start into, you know, the Reformation study today, because as you know, or maybe you don't know, October 31st is not, you know, just a celebration of trick-or-treating and all these sort of secular ideas. It's actually the anniversary of Martin Luther's nailing of his 95 Theses to the chapel door at Wittenberg, and so sort of that's the Reformation Day sort of celebration, the benchmark, obviously, of celebrating the Reformation. And, of course, a great time. All that we're talking about right now, though, as we said a number of weeks ago, as we kind of moved into this latter part of the Middle Ages, is really setting the stage more prominently for the Reformation. When you really look at what we've been looking at really recently and looking at the Crusades and even last week, zeroing in on the theological rationalization for the Crusader mindset or the era of the Crusader and how that really brought to bear where the church was. It brought it to bear in bold relief and really in vivid display of this merging of church and state ideology and this merging of doctrine with secular worldly pursuits of power. You begin to see how this is from a, especially from a theological standpoint, setting the stage for a need for tremendous reformation in the church, and particularly in the clergy and in the doctrines of the church. So we're going to continue to set that stage. We're going to wrap up kind of our summary review of this time and period of the Crusades. We haven't really talked a lot about all the events of the Crusades, and that's kind of been intentional. The fact of the matter is when you look at a range of church historians, you'll see that the Crusades did not really accomplish much at all, if anything. In fact, the net result of the Crusades that we're going to look at today, if you just sort of net it all out, it's not really a good outcome in any respect. No matter how you set up the goals and objectives of the Crusades, even in terms of how they were set up to be accomplishing certain things in their time, didn't work out. And so as I thought about this more and more, I kind of continue to hearken back to the Tower of Babel account in Genesis, where you have man wanting to ascend to the heights of God, build his tower and reach, you know, some man-made ascension of wisdom, of authority, of control of his own destiny, whatever it might be. And really this period of time in the Middle Ages is reflective of that as well. In fact, when you look at this period of time, one of the things that gets brought up as a hallmark of this period of history, even corresponding with the period of time of the Crusades, is this rise of Gothic architecture. And who's traveled to Europe and seen some of the great, you know, Gothic cathedrals in Europe? I mean, many people have. I mean, it's like one of those things where you go and you see these things, right? I've only had the privilege, I guess you'd say, of seeing one. I had to travel to Germany on business a number of years ago, and I got to see the cathedral in Cologne, as we would call it, in Cologne, Germany. It's the largest cathedral in Germany. And it definitely is reflective of the architecture of the time. The other great cathedral that has been in the news in recent years is the cathedral at Notre Dame in France, right? Because it succumbed to fire and a lot of it was destroyed and a lot of the cultural and artistic treasures inside it were destroyed by fire, which obviously is emblematic of the nature of these kinds of things, right? None of them are really reflective of any sustainable, you know, ongoing presence. None of them are guaranteed to reflect the person or nature of God at all. But this Gothic architecture that really emerged during this period of time is really reflective of the heart and mind of the people of that time, and really in particular the church in that time. And that is this aspirational kind of rising to the heights, these spires that just go up into the heavens and really mark the landscape of any town or region with the presence of the church. And it was to be a statement of power and authority theoretically, the power and authority of God as represented in the church, but ultimately, as we all know, the way man's bent toward corruption and toward pride lent itself to the pride of man and to man's conquest and acquisition of power, and that was also characteristic of the church, as we'll see as we move through this. But you even look at the architecture of that period of time, and you can see this heart and mind that is developed in the height of this Middle Age period, that would not only lead to these theological rationalizations that we looked at in Pope Urban's speech to launch the First Crusade, but it led to this mindset this is part of us building the kingdom of God on earth. If the kingdom of God was to manifest on earth, what would it look like? And so if you apply that to architecture and you start thinking in those terms, then you can kind of start to see how that would infuse people's, you know, thoughts about how things were being built. Now, one thing I took away from this and just kind of this brief reading of this rise of Gothic architecture and these building of these grand cathedrals. Hundreds of cathedrals built during this period of time, many of them in France, but also in other places in Europe. I will say that when I think about our building project, I know that Notre Dame was being built for well over 100 years. So, and others, you know, similar time frames. So I'm pretty confident we're going to come in under that for our church and our building. So that was encouraging to me. That's one takeaway that I had in this study. But the commitment that they had to constructing these edifices is exemplified in the long time that they took to build them. The enormous investment of money and human capital and labor and time can't be overstated. It's just enormous. And when you see any of these, you can see how, I mean, it's hard to imagine that these edifices were built in the time that they were built in. But they're just unbelievable structures. But they're much like the Tower of Babel in terms of what was behind them, what was motivating them. It wasn't exactly like the Tower of Babel in terms of the mindset of the people, but it was similar, very similar. It was this merging of man's ability to build and to aspire and to achieve great things for God. So you add that little caveat at the end. This is for God. And one of the ways that they would reflect this in the architecture is through the stained glass. There was this building of the structures to the heights with these spires just reaching up into the heavens. And then this installing of stained glass. And that's to indicate God's condescension and streaming down to man through these beautiful and ornate windows that they'd put in these buildings. So anyway, that just kind of gives you an indication of what was also going on. You have conquest through war, rightful conquest, theologically justified. God is on our side. God wills it was the battle cry of the First Crusade. God wills this. Theological rationalization for literally human conquest that transpired in such a way that was no different than any other form of warfare at that time. It was violent. It was bloody. It was rapacious. There was vast immorality on the battlefield and taking these towns and sacking these villages, all under the umbrella of ultimate forgiveness. Because if you committed to being a crusader, to go and fight God's battle as part of God's army, you were granted a special indulgence by the Pope himself that would basically cover your sins. So it gave these warriors, so you can imagine, or maybe I can't really imagine, but you can kind of maybe think in this direction. You know how many of you have played sports, you know, growing up or whatever? You played competitive sports, right? What happens, particularly in football, you know, one of the more sort of aggressive types of sports in America, of course. You know, you get around, you know, the huddle before the game starts, and you have people jumping up and down and getting hyped up, and there's this fever pitch that's reached, and then they go out. And I mean, there's just all this physical energy and aggression that kind of gets amped up and amped up. Well, imagine if your life was actually on the line. Imagine if there were swords and there were arrows and there were, flaming things thrown at you and rocks and just violent physical hand-to-hand combat. Imagine the furor of war in that period of time, but lacing it with a battle cry, God wills it. And fueling the passions, the sort of the guttural passions of the warrior during this period of time. That was the Crusades. And they would take that sort of that unleashed and uncontrolled fervor and passion, unredeemed men, men who were not indwelt by the Spirit of God, but who believed in the cause and really bought into this overarching indulgence granted to them by the Pope that would cover their sins. They would take all of that into the battlefield and into these towns and villages, and they would rape and they would plunder. All under the banner of the cross, all of them wearing the cross. Now, that's not to say that they were all that way. It's not to say that there weren't men of piety who sought to be a part of this. I mean, I'm not trying to characterize. I didn't meet all of the Crusaders personally. I didn't get to know them. I'm just saying that those are elements that you find as you study this, the history of this period of time. And that's what you find anytime you try to create some type of man-made version of salvation. Or some man-made effort to commune with God or to be reconciled to God. It always results in man's pride being stroked and built up. Go to the time of the Gospels and you see what was going on with the Pharisees. That was man's effort to adhere to the law to such a degree that it put him on a pedestal above other men. Even so much to say that he could call out the actual Messiah as a blasphemer and be a part of God's providential work to put him on the cross. So that's what you have going on during this period of time. So what was the outcome? I mean, where did this lead to? I mean, I gave you kind of this initial launch in the theological rationalization in Pope Urban's speech last week, but let's just kind of look at some of the outcomes. I showed you this map. I mean, I wish I had a broader view of it, but I couldn't find one that would really stretch across the screen. But basically, the First Crusade resulted in the establishment of the Crusader states. This was the only crusade in the whole run of the Crusade period that resulted in victory of any meaningful type. Okay? And there are a total of 7 to 9 crusades during this period of time, depending upon what you count as an official crusade from a historical perspective. But the First Crusade was the only one that resulted in any kind of military victory. This was the period of time. Obviously, Pope Urban's speech at the Council of Clermont took place in 1095. And so by 1099, they made their way to Jerusalem and took the city of Jerusalem and basically seized control of these parts of territory from Edessa up in the north and the east, and all the way down to Jerusalem in the south, okay? And they established these different kingdoms, if you will, these different territories, principally the kingdom of Jerusalem. And then you had these other key, places, the county of Tripoli, the principality of Antioch, the county of Edessa, the principality of Armenia and Cilicia. Then you have in the purple over here, the Byzantine Empire. That's the Eastern Roman Empire, as you see on that part of the slide. Down here is Muslim territory. Okay, so they took all of this and took control of all of this. Again, the Seljuk Turks still have control of this part of the land. But they did seize a key part of the Holy Land and surrounding territories, and they basically set up their own kingdoms that were under the control of the Crusaders, the nobles that led the initial Crusader forces became rulers of this part of the world. They became kings. Now, again, what they did was they just basically exported a feudal type of governance into the Holy Land. That's all they did. They took their own sort of way of ruling and reigning and setting up society and setting up laws and setting up, stratification of society. And they just sort of set the same thing up in that part of the world. And so this is kind of what was in place roughly from 1099 to 1144. In 1144, Edessa falls to the Muslims. So that's the beginning of the end of this period of time of taking back the Holy Land, as was the original sort of purpose that was laid out. Defending the Byzantine Empire against the onslaught of Muslim invasion and taking back the land in which Jesus lived and trod and had his ministry and went to the cross and died and was buried and was resurrected. This is holy land and it belongs to us as God's people. We must take it back. So Edessa falls. You have the Second Crusade that was launched in 1147. This was in response to this fall of Edessa. This involved actually two kings in the Crusade. You had Louis VII of France and Conrad III of Germany. They laid siege to Damascus, but they failed to capture the city. The German king kind of had enough and decided to just abandon the whole effort and went back home. I mean, you can imagine they're far from home. They've left their homeland. They've left their principal areas of operation and culture and rulership and the comforts of home to go and fight these battles. So the king of Germany at that time, Conrad III, decided he was done with the effort and he left. And then the French king, Louis VII, soon abandoned the mission thereafter. So no effect, no success in that one. Then you have Jerusalem falling in 1187. This was a major defeat by the Muslim leader Saladin, a very famous unifying Muslim leader of that period of time. He takes Jerusalem. This initiated a third crusade in 1189 to 1192. This was led up by Frederick I of Barbarossa, or also known as Barbarossa of Germany. He died on his way to the Holy Land, so he didn't even make it there to the battle. This also involved Philip II of France and Richard I of England. So this was sort of a big effort on the part of major rulers of major parts of what was then known as the Holy Roman Empire. And Philip II, he ended up abandoning the battle because he couldn't get on the same page with Richard I. So you had these two kings that were in conflict, and so the French king abandoned the battlefield. Richard I of England, he won several battles but was not able to recapture Jerusalem and ended up establishing a bit of a treaty with Saladin to enable pilgrims to continue to travel into the Holy Land and visit the holy sites in Jerusalem. But again, they didn't take back the Holy Land. They didn't take back Jerusalem. Then you have the Fourth Crusade in 1202 to 1204. This is under the rulership of Pope Innocent III, who was probably known as one of the most powerful popes during this period of time, probably of all time in terms of actual sort of military, social, civil, religious power. Pope Innocent III certainly at the top. And he raised an army to go on another crusade. He could not abide by the fact that the Holy Land was under Muslim control. And so he sort of helped launch the Fourth Crusade. In fact, this one was a complete disaster because it did not even result in them making it to the Holy Land. In fact, the Crusaders basically sacked Constantinople. So they didn't even get to the Holy Land. They stopped in Constantinople, sacked Constantinople, and set up what was this very short-lived Latin empire in the East. So remember, the East was Greek, but they set up this short-term, I think a couple of years, of a Latin empire in Constantinople. So you can just see how this is really all about conquest. It's about seizing of territory, seizing of authority. You get so far removed from even ill-conceived and heretical, in certain points, theological justification that Pope Urban tried to lay out for us as a reason to go on this crusade, right? Now this is just all about conquest. It's all about man's lust for power, lust for land, lust for authority. And so that's what took place as a result of the Fourth Crusade. Then you have the seminal fall of Acre in 1291, which really marks the end of the Crusader era. There were other expeditions and crusades that took place leading up to this point, but none of them successful. None of them achieved their objective. None of them accomplished anything that they set out to accomplish. And certainly, didn't accomplish the retaking of the Holy Land. So all in all, you have this one initial First Crusade that, if you want to call it successful, it was successful. Was it successful from the standpoint of the church, in the history of the church? Absolutely not. It was built upon a horrible, faulty, unbiblical theological rationalization of Pope Urban II. But from a military standpoint, it was successful for a short period of time, but you can see that it did not last very, very long. And the seizing of the Holy Land and all that ambition and all that fever pitch did not accomplish anything related to what it set out to accomplish. However, there were some things that were accomplished, and this is not, this really is where it gets worse. If it's not bad enough to think about establishing a theological rationale for going to seize lands under the banner of the cross, namely that God wills this. This is part of, remember we went through this, God has chosen you Franks for this purpose. You are elect for this purpose, while these Turks are, they're cursed. And so there's this sovereignty of God purpose. There's this part of your salvation mindset that was invoked by Pope Urban. These theological reasonings that he put forward, none of those purposes, none of those rationales were enough to lead to victory. And it kind of raises the question, if God wills it, then why didn't God will it? I mean, it's kind of like, it just didn't happen. So God wills it, but somewhere, I guess you would have to invoke a little bit of word faith theology to say they didn't have enough faith to conquer. I don't know. I don't know what the rationale would have been, but clearly it was faulty at best, and that's probably putting it too lightly in terms of the rationale and the motivation. But there were some results that we need to look at. The probably the most damning result of it all was this idea of the church wielding two swords. The church wielding two swords. Of course, you would know that this is reference to the sword of the Spirit and then the actual physical sword of warfare. This brought complete embracing and justification of the church as the bearer or wielder, I should say. Not necessarily always the bearer, but the wielder of both swords of authority and power, and wielding them simultaneously. To give you an idea of how this mindset even was imbibed by the Crusaders, this is a quote from the period of the time of the Crusades, the First Crusade. This is taken from Bruce Shelley's book, and this is one of the Crusaders said, "Some of our men cut off the heads of their enemies. Others shot them with arrows so that they fell from the towers. Others tortured them longer by casting them into the flames. It was necessary to pick one's way over the bodies of men and horses. But these were small matters compared to what happened at the Temple of Solomon, where men rode in blood up to their knees and bridle reins. Indeed, it was a just and splendid judgment of God that this place should be filled with the blood of the unbelievers, since it had suffered so long from their blasphemies." Okay, so this was fully embraced by the Crusaders, this idea that the church rightfully bears or wields two swords. The sword of the Spirit and the sword of physical force and authority, the sword of battle. It goes on, "At nightfall, the Crusaders' hands were still bloody when they folded them in prayer and knelt at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre," and then quoting again from that day, "sobbing for excess of joy." So at the end of this battle, you have these warriors who are fighting at the behest of the Pope and his clarion call to go and defend the Eastern Empire, but also, more importantly, to take back the Holy Land, their rightful land, sort of imbibing the promise of Abraham, right, and saying this is our land to take back on behalf of the people of God. They were sobbing in excess of joy over their defeat, or over their ability to defeat the infidels. And yet they were doing this in the midst of a blood-soaked, blood-stained battlefield. Okay? Now, as I said, Pope Innocent was was in the midst of all this. He actually was the one that instituted one of the Crusades, as I said before. This gives you another idea of the how this mindset of power and authority rested with the church. And really, remember, the church, who was the church ultimately in that day and time? The Pope. In other words, the Pope was the vicar of Christ. The church as the body of Christ, Pope as the vicar of Christ, Pope as the representative of Christ. And to give you an idea of what was in the mind of Pope Innocent at this particular time, as it relates to this power and this authority, that would lead to the justified wielding of either sword as was expedient, the sword of the Spirit or the sword of authority, the actual physical sword of warfare, or wielding them both simultaneously, one justifying the other. This is one of the things that he said. The successor of Peter is the vicar of Christ. He has been established as a mediator between God and man, below God but beyond man, less than God but more than man, who shall judge all and be judged by no one. Now that's a convenient position to have when you're the vicar of Christ, right? When you're the Pope. Again, he references it in third person, I guess out of humility, I'm not sure. But nonetheless, the statement really reflects what was in the heart and mind of Pope Innocent at that given point in time in the midst of this Crusader era. And so you can see how, you know, this carried forward, you know, from Pope Urban on into the other popes during this period of time, where this idea of authority rested in the hands of the Vicar of Christ to wield this authority, one sword in one hand, one sword in the other, as he saw fit, as the vicar of Christ. After all, he is below God, but he's definitely more than man. And so if I see myself in that light, I am above you, and I've been placed above you by Christ himself, and I am able, by God's authority, to wield both swords, then if I deem you unworthy of life, I take it from you with the sword. It's just that easy. It's just that straightforward. It's just that simple. And so this kind of papal authority sort of reaches a new zenith point. You remember as you look through the through these various periods of history, particularly beginning with the Constantinian era, but really developing beyond that, where you have this idea of an imperial church, where the church and its ecclesiastical leadership would identify themselves more and more and more with positions of authority that are more worldly in their definition, imperial ideas of authority in the church. And so the church became more about that kind of mindset. Well, you get to this zenith point where you're no longer just trying to wield spiritual authority or wield political influence by certain alliances with leaders, by sort of political maneuverings and machinations, by strategically placing bishops in certain places that are on your side and that are part of your alliance. Now you're fully wielding physical force as a part of your mantle to execute your authority and your judgment. That's a new level of authority that the papacy ascended to during this period of time of the Crusades. A whole new level of authority. Pope Boniface VIII puts a fine point on it. He says, "We are taught by the words of the gospel that in this, the church and under her control, there are two swords, the spiritual and the temporal. Both of these, i.e. the spiritual and the temporal swords, are under the control of the church. The first is wielded by the church. The second is wielded on behalf of the church. The first is wielded by the hands of the priests. The second by the hands of kings and soldiers, but at the wish and by the permission of the priests." Now, if you are the vicar of Christ and you are stating a doctrine about wielding two swords and you're trying to sort of, you know, split hairs between who's actually wielding the sword, is it not in fact the case that the person who controls those who are wielding the sword are in fact wielding the sword? In other words, you can't create this false dichotomy, this imaginary dichotomy between one. I mean, in other words, he's trying to sanctify the fact that the priests only wield the spiritual sword. But they control the soldiers and the kings that wield the physical sword on the behalf of the church. So it's really a sort of an abuse of sort of a manipulative way to view this place of authority. The other thing that came out of this period of time, and this is really kind of an accurate way to view it, because what flowed out of this period of time were even new monastic orders that wielded the sword. The Knights Templar, the Knights Hospitallers, these new orders were actually, they considered themselves monks, but they were also warriors. So they were called warrior monks. So they basically merged this idea of two swords into one order of people. And they took on the orders of a particular monastery, but they also were knights who wielded swords and trained for battle and engaged in crusades and that kind of thing. So this particular period of time, you can see how it's setting the stage more and more and more for a need of reformation. This rising to the power of authority in such a way that you're wielding the sword, this ultimately leads to the period of the Inquisitions, where the church begins to eradicate heresy through violent use of force. What they believed to be heresy, I should say, not true heresy. It became a rationale for persecuting and killing Jews or anybody that represented any kind of Protestant ideas of Christian doctrine. And so this use of force became part and parcel to the church in the way that it wielded its power and its authority. It reached a zenith point during this period of time. I want you to listen to how Bruce Shelley kind of concludes this sort of under his heading of the results of this holy cause. He says this: "The long-range results of two centuries of crusading zeal are not impressive. If the primary purpose of the Crusades were to win the Holy Land, to check the advance of Islam, and to heal the schism between the Eastern and Western churches, then the Crusades failed miserably." That was one of the big aims. That was part of Urban's vision to unite the East and the Western church. This was an opportunity because the emperor in the East had cried out for help. And so this is an opportunity for the Eastern and Western church to be reunited. And as I said, one of the subsequent crusades resulted in the sacking of Constantinople. It's not a good way to reunify the two branches of the church. "They failed miserably," Shelley says. "For a time, four kingdoms led by Jerusalem were established along the eastern Mediterranean coast of the Holy Land. In these, the crusades created three semi-monastic military orders, as I just mentioned. The Templars, or Knights of the Temple, whose first headquarters were on the site of the old Temple of Jerusalem. The Hospitallers, or Knights of St. John of Jerusalem, who were founded originally to care for the sick and wounded, and the Teutonic Knights, exclusively a German order. Combining monasticism and militarism, these orders had as their aims the protection of all pilgrims and perpetual war against the Muslims. These men of the cross could put 500 armed knights into the field, and their great castles guarded the roads and passes against Muslim attack. For two centuries, the Templars, in white robes decorated with a red cross, the Hospitallers, in black robes with a white cross, the Teutonic Knights, in white robes with a black cross, were common sights in the Crusader states. Perhaps the most significant result was the added splendor the Crusades brought to the papacy. Not only did Pope Urban II launch the First Crusade, but the popes throughout the period were the primary inspiration for fresh expeditions. They, not the emperors, strove to unite Christendom against Islam. The new military orders and the new bishops in the Holy Land and those in Constantinople for a time were under papal protection and service. The Holy War was the papacy reaching for universal sovereignty, one united church, west and east. But like the Gothic architects who built their cathedrals higher and higher until the towers cracked and then crashed to earth, the popes tried the impossible. Christian Europe had no need for Syria or Jerusalem. She took them in a fit of enthusiasm and had no power to retain them. When trade and towns turned rulers and people to new interests at home, the popes remained faithful to the old ideal, Christian control of the Holy Land, It was their constant preoccupation. So even when the people grew tired, even when the crusader spirit died down, even when interests at home began to captivate their attention, the popes remained passionate and vigorous for this effort for control under the umbrella of one united church, under the banner of the cross. Unfortunately, the popes never held two basic truths that we must never forget. Christianity's highest satisfactions are not guaranteed by possession of special places, and the sword is never God's way to extend Christ's church. This fault assured the religious collapse of the whole structure. So here you have at the end of this crusader era, really nothing meaningful accomplished, nothing substantive accomplished, even according to their own stated objectives. Unifying the East and the West, taking back and seizing and controlling and protecting the Holy Land. None of those things were accomplished. But what was accomplished was much of what we see today, a justification on the part of Christ's enemies to lash out against any effort to proclaim the gospel in that part of the world. As I said at the very outset of our study, one of the greatest uses against Christian evangelism, even amongst those who are not inclined to be a fan of Islamic religion, are the Crusades. Pointing to the Crusades. Creating a moral equivalence between, for example, jihad and crusade. They're the same thing, and the source of it is unbridled religious fervor that does nothing but destroy people and remove people's actual freedoms, and it takes control of people's mindset, and it reduces man to something base. So that's the nature and essence of the accomplishment of the Crusades. Nothing good. Nothing worth heralding about. And this is an interesting thing. There are tendencies on the part of some, I think, to try to defend the Crusades in some, as sort of like, well, you know, we got to somehow defend the home team, right? I mean, this is part of Christian church history, so somehow we've got to put some kind of positive spin on the Crusades against this attack on behalf of either atheism or Islam or something else. That's a failed endeavor. The fact of the matter is that the mission of the gospel is one of proclamation, and the call of the Christian pilgrim is to not grow attached to the stuff of this earth, that we are sojourners passing through, we are witnesses to the resurrection of Christ, and we are called to suffer and potentially die for that witness against adversaries of official and unofficial forms. That's the call and the mission of the gospel. So here we are. This is what's next. What sets the stage for the Reformation? Well, that, by the way, that's Martin Luther. That's his hammer. By the way, this is a photo. This is not a portrayal. This is a... I got this off of Luther's Instagram account. But you can see how you think about this environment. We're going to talk about other things that lead up to this particular moment in time as a sort of a seminal moment, and it captivates our minds about the Reformation. We're going to look at some key people and events that took place prior to this. But you can clearly see how the church was in need of reform. And this is, the Crusades were just a part of setting that stage and moving us in that direction toward a more biblical understanding of the gospel and of the life of the believer in light of the saving work of Christ. Any final thoughts or questions before we close in prayer?